morning, and I'm 7 hours ahead, so that's kind of late. But I did want to have the class, because I always feel that the times that I can't make it, so then we don't have it. But when I can, the worst that could happen is that I'll lose this track. Right? I'll fall asleep over the book. Okay. Well, maybe we'll go to it for about an hour or so and see how what we can do there. I'm happy to say that the last thing I did in Israel last night was go to a wedding. I went to a wedding last night, just to the chuppah, and I went from the chuppah to the airport. It was a wedding of a friend of Ezra's, who was a friend of ours, a young man who just one of these amazing young Israeli people. He had been a guest of ours in Maine a few years ago. And I remember climbing up Cadillac Mountain, and this guy would run up the mountain, and then the rest of us would sort of do our thing. You guys climb Cadillac when you're up there, right? Well, this guy ran up, and up Cadillac Mountain. So last night we got married.
And the wedding.
What? Well, he was pretty steady last night, to tell you the truth. This was at Ramat Rachel, next to Bethlehem. Kibbutz Ramat Rachel, the Egyptian army in 1948 came at Jerusalem, and the Israeli army, the Haganah, actually suffered a loss right at Ramat Rachel, and then for some strange reason the Egyptian army stopped. Nobody ever could figure out why the Egyptian army stopped. Of course, it's obvious why. There was a greater hand involved in that moment. Otherwise, they would have moved right into Jerusalem. Ramat Rachel is right on the outskirts of the center of Jerusalem, and from there, Wadi. And you see the old city and the Har HaBayit. Such a nice place to get married. The chuppah is set up outside. It was, of course, it gets dark early in the winter. The weather was relatively mild compared with this ridiculous weather that I see you have here in New York. I don't know what you guys are doing here. It's just so lovely, mild in Israel. Jerusalem is much colder than Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv was just wonderful. Jerusalem was relatively cold. But last night at the wedding, I had on what I had on now. And I was outside. Roughly what I have on now. And so there were a few aspects of this wedding which interested me a great deal, partly because I'm in the business, and probably because we're studying this material. So I wanted to pick up where we left off last time in the Rambam. You remember we were reading the Rambam's summary of the Hilchot Kiddushin, the laws of Kiddushin, and he had started out with a bit of what I might call the history of religion. His own speculation, based on a rather sophisticated sense of what was known in his own day about other religions. And he starts off, I'll just review the first of the comments that he makes. Koda matan Torah, haya adam pogea isha bashuk. Before the giving of the Torah, a man would meet a woman in the marketplace. Im ratza hu vihi lisa ota. If he and she wanted to get married, machnisa l'toch beto, he would bring her into his house, uvoala beno levein atzmo, and he would have intercourse with her, between him and her. It's yelo l'isha, and then she would become his wife. Kivan shenitna Torah, once the Torah was given, nitzavu Yisrael she'im yatzah ish l'isa isha, if a man wants to marry a woman from that point on, yikneo tatechila bifnei edim, first he needs to acquire her before witnesses, ve'achar kach tiye lo ne'isha, and afterwards she will be his wife. She'ne'amar, as was said, ki kach ish isha uva'elea. Dan pointed out to me after the class that the verse here is not the same verse as in our text in the Gemara. The Gemara in fact says, ki kach ish isha uva'elea. When a man takes a woman for a wife and has intercourse with her. There are two different verses, in fact, in Deuteronomy, and one is used in the Baraita that we have read in the Gemara, and the Rambam actually quotes the other verse here. And then he goes on to say what are the forms of acquisition that have to be taken here. And there are the three forms of acquisition, kesef, shtar, and biya. Money, a written document, or sexual relations. And then we spoke last time about the odd statement that he makes that money is from the rabbis and the other two are from the Torah. But let's put that aside now. So he goes on, Gimel. Kevan shenikneta ha'isha v'naaset nekudeshet. Once the woman is acquired, and she is then called Nikudeshet. Afal pisha lo nif'ala v'lo nichnasa l'vet bala, even though they have not had sexual relations, and she does not enter her husband's home. But remember now in the time of the Talmud, the Kiddushin is separated from Kiddushin or Erisin, it's the same thing. This initial ceremony of acquisition was separated from the final part, namely the chuppah, sometimes by as much as a year. Right? It's only in the Middle Ages that the ceremony was put together to be the ceremony that we have now. So after the kiddushin was completed, the acquisition was made either through kesef, shtar, or bia, one of the three, at that point she would be nikudeshet. That's the way the woman would be referred to, as Nikudeshet. One of the, I thought the interesting things I was forgetting last night, was that at the moment when the groom gave the ring to the bride, because the ring is now the kesef, the ring is symbolic of the money, it is that which has value. He gives the ring to the bride, Harei HaMekudeshet B'Tabat Zo Kedat Roshei B'Yisrael. So, he says that, puts the ring on her finger. She shows the ring to the Edim, the witnesses who are there. Suddenly there is a loud, loud noise. And it must have been 50 people called out, Mekudeshet! Mekudeshet! Never heard that. That is their custom, is to call out at that moment, Nikudeshet. And that's exactly what I just said to you here, Nikudeshet. Right? After the kinyan has taken place, right, the acquisition has been completed, then there is a new set of circumstances, which is that there is a Nikudeshet. Okay? So that was the first thing that happened. So of course the mode of acquisition that we use is kesef. That too is fascinating. Before the wedding began, as is the case in many a traditional wedding, there is a chasnas tesh, and then there is the bedek, the kala is seated, and you go to see the kala, and you go to see the chatan. Where the chatan was, they were drawing up the ketubah, which is what is normally done as it's what is called the chasnas tish. The ketubah is drawn up. So the Rav, who was the Mesadik Kedushin, who was the one who handled the wedding, was Rav Nathan Greenberg, Rabbi Nathan Greenberg, who some of you will remember, Torben Ozaru, about 3 years ago. He gave a session on Chanukah according to the writings of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. So he was the Mesadeh Kiddushin. He's a Breslov Chosid and an intellectual. He's very knowledgeable in 30 different fields. So he was explaining during the drawing up of the ketubah, they ketubah is for Matayim Zuz. First marriage, a betota, a woman who has not been married before, the virgin marriage, is for 200 zuz, you write into the ketubah. And we've discussed that, and you asked me how much is 200 zuz, and I said to you that, well, if you figure that Zabi Naba, Chagadiyad, Zabi Naba, Bitre Zuze, right? And my father bought for 2 zuz in 1 kid. So if you have 200 zuz, that's 100 goats. So your basic stipulation in the ketubah is, in effect, 100 goats. In addition to that, in the ketubah, and the detail is in Masechet Ketubot, and we've talked about this too, there is an additional gift from the groom to the bride. This is not a dowry, the opposite of a dowry. This is from the groom to the bride, of what's called Tosefet Ketubah. Tosefet Ketubah, in addition to the ketubah. Ketubah there means 200 zuz. 200 zuz. And the Tosefet Ketubah is another 200 zuz. That's what we have in all of our wedding contracts. You have in your wedding contract 200 zuz. I know yours would be 100 zuz. Yours would be 100 zuz. Look at that.
Used to be less.
What?
Used to be less. You
had to get to the right amount. Okay. So that is that's standard procedure. So I hear Rav Nathan says, he says, no, when you get to the Tosefet Ketubah, that has to be done in Shkalim. Done in Shkalim. No, so the question is, how many shkalim is it worth? So he did the research on the internet, he said, and the Tosefet Ketubah, he wrote into that ketubah last night, is 36,000 shekels. Can you believe that? Believe me, today, I unfortunately learned the shekels in much better shape than the dollar.
It is.
Every time I went to cash my money, it was worse. It was a big mistake. Big mistake. The dollar is terrible. And the shekel is now the strong currency. Vis-a-vis the dollar, for sure. I assume there must be other currencies that are also strong. Euro is probably strong, but the shekel is a strong currency. So the 200 zuz are worth 36,000 shekels. I couldn't believe it. After the wedding, I went over to Rav Nathan and I said, did I hear you right? I said, how do you know that it's 36,000 shekels? So he explained to me that he did this research on the internet. And, I mean, there are a lot of rabbinic sources about it. And it's kesef tsaruf. It's pure silver. Pure silver. And she said that that's what it is. And so I asked another rabbi there, I said, you agree with this? So Lubavitcher rabbi. So Lubavitcher says to me, well, he says, I still write 200 zuz. I said, you're like me. Me and the Lubavitcher, all the Lubavitcher guy, we write 200 zuz. But the Breslov guy, he writes 36,000 shekels. He said, that's what it's worth. It's actually worth 36,000 shekels. 36,000 is a shekel, yesterday was worth 3.8 shekels to the dollar. So that's, you're talking money. You're talking money. So that was my first real surprise. This was even before the wedding began, that First of all, all of this was done in shekel, and that the shekel amount was so considerable. No questions so far. I wouldn't doubt. In fact, as you saw, do you remember in the very beginning here, at the beginning of the Mishnah, it said, it made it clear that the coinage here, it said the chesed starubia, the chesed bechamer in the dinar, shaved dinar, bechamer in the fruta, bechamer fruta, the chama hi fruta. And how much is a fruta? Achad mishmona bi'isara italki. And they had to define it in terms of other currencies. Right? It's one-eighth of an Italian isar. So, fascinating. Here in the Mishnah, it's defined in terms of Italian currency.
It's the Roman
Empire. Because it's the Roman Empire. It's the Roman Empire, right? So the shekel was defined externally, even as it is today. And in the halachic discussions that you have about all of these coinages, inflation is a major issue. Because the question is whether, when you're talking about kesef, you mean the old value or the new value. And that's why, Nathan made the point last night. He said, Shloshim ushlone elef shekel shkalim chadashim. Shkalim chadashim, because that in fact is what it is. The shekel is not the shekel, but the shekel chadash. It's a new value that was revalued according to inflationary issues. So it was defined in terms of the shekel chadash.
One way to think about it would be the average number of days you have to work to
Poor people had to make the same commitment. Question is whether you could pay it. So that's the issue. Or you might have that money in your estate. You might not have that money in your pocket, but you might have that money in your estate. So some of the estate, it would become an issue. Remember, there are two ways that the ketubah really comes into effect. One is in the case of the death of the husband, that it provides an immediate source of income for the wife. That this is a lien on the estate, which is paid before the children are paid out of the estate. The direct line of inheritance is from the father to the sons. There are no sons to the daughters, but not through the wife. So this is the first thing on the estate. The other situation in which the ketubah is paid is divorce. So, in a way, we know the reason why the ketubah is there vis-a-vis divorce is that it is a discouragement of divorce. I think that I explained to you that there were a variety of methods tried to discourage divorce in rabbinic times. The Torah permits divorce. The Torah says if he sees on her an unseemly thing, v'chatav la sefer kmitut, he shall write for her a bill of divorce. Well, it makes it very easy to get divorced. So, in order to discourage divorce, rabbis tried a variety of means. The most effective means of all was to make it expensive. And now you can see how expensive it was. It was really quite expensive, assuming that using various parameters, probably whatever this would be would have been what it was in the ancient world, but effectively the same thing. That's a lot. Now, I'm just complete gimel. Kevan shenikneta isha v'naseh nekudeshet, afal pi shelo nivala. So, once the acquisition has taken place, the assumption here, I think, is that this is done through the exchange of the giving of money. Afal pi shelo nivala, even though there has been no sexual relation, Halo nichnasa leved bala, and she has not entered her husband's house. Harei hi eshet ish, she becomes a married woman. Vehaba alea chutz mi bala, and any other men who were to have relations, sexual relations with her, chayav mitat bed din, is obliged, would be punished with capital punishment. Right? He would be required to lose his life. Imra sala garesh, and if he wanted to divorce her at that point, shicha get, she would need a get. So again, the initial stage of the kiddushin has force in that externally, as far as the rest of the world goes, she's married. Again, she doesn't go into his house, she goes back to her house, he goes back to his family's house, and until the next stage takes place, namely the chuppah, or the nisu'in, till that takes place, they're not actually married. I'm sorry, they can't have relations with one another. And it goes on in the Dalit. Kodem matan Torah. Somewhat repetitive. Haya adam pokea isha bishuk. A man would meet a woman in a marketplace. Imatahu vihi noten la schara. Here, he gets into another subject. A man meets a woman in the marketplace. And he wants, and she wants, a mutual agreement. He pays her a certain amount of money. Now, ten la schara, sachar, is a wage. He pays her wage. Uvo el ota, and he has sex with her. Okay, he's talking about a situation of prostitution. Okay, al emaderech olech. Al emaderech means anywhere at Parashat Drachim, wherever this happens to take place. Olech, and he walks away. Okay, on the road. So in other words, this is the imagery here is from the story of Tamar in the Book of Reshi. Yehuda and Tamar. He you remember, Yehuda had a son, and their son died. He was married to Tamar, and the son died, and he had to give another son as a levirate marriage, right? We've been studying about levirate marriage in this Masachah, and he never did it. He never did it. So eventually, he's by the way, and he decides to have relations with a woman, and he pays her for it. He pays her for it. And eventually, she shows him, she says, well, she becomes pregnant. And then she says, well, whoever gave me these things is the source of what's going on here. Of course, he knew that it was what he had given. So that's where the language is taken from here. So this recalls that, and he goes on and gives it it's defined in language. V'zohi hanikret kedesha. This is what is meant when the Torah uses the term kedesha, a kedesha. A kedesha, in other words, is a prostitute. Okay? That's a prostitute. There, the nature of the relationship is he gives money to her, right? There's a consent. Part of that consent is the money that changes hands between him and her. Mishenitna haTorah. Once the Torah was given, ne'esra ha-kadesha, the situation of the kadesha is prohibited. Shemiyamar, as it says, lo tiye kadesha mibnot Yisrael. The daughters of Israel should not be prostitutes. Kadesha. Lefticha, therefore, kol ha-boer li'isha l'shem zinut, whoever has relations with a woman for as a harlot, below kiddushin, without kiddushin, lokem in a Torah. That person has transgressed the law of the Torah, deserves lashes, lefisha ba'al kadesha, because he has had relations with a kadesha.
If she's looking at anything like anyone Jewish,
doesn't matter. Don't say anything about. Who said? Who said?
You just said it.
Where? Where I said that? Where?
That the Torah said that the daughter of Israel.
Second, many reasons. You show what I said to you. Lo tiye kedesha mibnot Yisrael. Right.
Okay.
Oh, so you're saying, but all the other kedeshot are all. No comment on that. That's actually better. It's actually more complicated. Okay. But don't look for an easy out here. Okay. I understand. Now, what I wanted you to see here was, in the context, the way the Rambam brings this, realize the similarity in structure between what we are studying and this forbidden relationship. Right? The forbidden relationship of the Kadesha involves the payment of money. Okay? The result of the payment of money, their sex. Well, we're familiar with that. I mean, we know that arrangement. That's the oldest business in the world, right? So in a fascinating way, he's bringing this here as he sort of gives you his history of religion's approach to the development of a concept, which the Rambam will do from time to time. I think what the Rambam is doing is to say, you know, what we have done is take a certain structure that existed, which was a structure, in effect, a profane structure, and that same structure is now used, the same form is used, to create mekudeshet, the holy structure, the holy structure. So that it's not just stum, as it were, that you have such a procedure. That comes because they used to do something, which now becomes forbidden, and now that action becomes transformed into the action of marriage, which is a highly limited relationship. I mean, as limited as could be. Okay?
So does that mean he's dismissing the literary rationale for
You mean the Torah sources of Hikaki Ishisha?
Right. They used it based on literary.
Correct. This is an anthropological type of approach, which the Rambam will frequently use. But he will occasionally use in order to discuss the development of a particular custom. I think I have said a little bit more than he is saying. Actually, I don't think that he is saying quite as much as what I'm saying. I'm just taking it a little bit further. And I think it's valid to say what I'm saying. I think that the way he structured this is to give us a sense of where this comes from and where it's going to.
It doesn't even matter what your business is.
That's absolutely right. I'm just see where he mentions. Well, he mentioned the witnesses already. Right, he doesn't repeat that in what's coming up here. But indeed, that's all part of it, correct. That's absolutely part of it. Okay? Yes?
What happened to it becomes the second life?
What happened with
the second life?
Right. This procedure is exactly the same procedure. In a polygamous society, which was that society, men could have more than one wife. The procedure for marrying the second wife is precisely the same as the procedure for the first wife. It doesn't differ. It would matter if the woman has already been married, but it would not matter if the man has already been married. Ketubah is the same ketubah. So it doesn't make any difference. Okay? Yes,
Lisa. For me, there's supposed to be a little bit of a contradiction, actually, because in the first example he gives, before Matan Torah, And then when a woman in the marketplace, they decided mutually to get married. He took her home, he had sex with her, they were married. The other example he gives, he meets a woman on the road. Now he pays her, by virtue of paying her, they're not married.
So that's helpful what you're saying, because in a way then what you have finally is a combination of the two. All right? You're paying her, she is married, and you're taking her home. Okay, so
it's complicated because you don't actually have to take her home. She's already married before you take her home.
That's correct. She is already married before you take her home. According to this procedure, that's correct. Well,
that's interesting.
Again, I think this is speculation. It's even speculation on his part. It's certainly speculation on, I'm speculating on what he means by what he says. It's double speculation. But I think that that's, if you'll allow that type of speculation, that's where he's coming from.
Well, he lived in the Muslim culture.
Yes.
So he may have viewed things differently than we would today, in a different culture, and he may have taken some elements of that time Muslim culture into consideration when he made these decisions.
Well, I don't know how that affects what he just said. Now, I think that Maimonides' principal interest, more than the Muslim culture, although it's not totally irrelevant, is that we know from the God for the Perplexed, there was current. At that time, well, the God to the Perplexed was written after the Mishneh Torah, so I don't know whether he was aware of it at this time. There was a book about the history of the Sabine religion. He writes about this in the God for the Perplexed. And that's one of the reasons why he develops this theory of sacrifice. In Maimonides, in the God for the Perplexed, he develops a theory of sacrifice where sacrifice comes out of other ancient pagan religions, and then it is transformed in Judaism, but eventually is even superseded in Judaism. That's his view of the sacrificial system. But it's based on the evidence he has, and that was apparently common among intellectuals in the Muslim world, not Islam per se, but what they knew about the history of religion. It was a very sophisticated time, much more sophisticated than our time, to tell you the truth, in that part of the world. These people were extremely learned. They were learned in the classics. The Arab philosophers were classical philosophers. They read the classics. They read them mostly in Arabic, as they had all been translated into Arabic at that period of time. And so they knew a great deal about the history of the world and the different practices that were current. So it went even beyond Islam, I think.
Okay.
Yes,
sir. How is it that the term for a prostitute could be so close to kiddushin?
It is said then that the reason why that is so is because it comes from the notion of temple prostitutes. Temple prostitutes were a basic part of the ancient world, where you had women and men. There were male prostitutes and female prostitutes. It was all kinds of relations here. And that was part of pagan custom and pagan ritual. If you want to see a good book on that subject, great novel, C.H. Lawrence, The Man Who Died. Wonderful. I shouldn't tell you wonderful. It's very pagan. I shouldn't be sending you to pagan sources. Very pagan. Very good book. He's consistent, let us say, on his approach to things. Much is to be learned from the edge lines. And among the things that you see there, he uses the myth of Isis and Osiris in Egyptian mythology all as part of the springtime festivals, and the sexual union as a very basic part of participating in where the cosmos is. And those kinds of things were, it is said, part of the pagan ritual. So when the Torah says that there shall be no, it says two things. It doesn't only say Kadesha, it says there shall not be a Kadesh or a Kadesha. Either one, either the male prostitute or the female prostitute. And the understanding is then that that comes from pagan ritual. So that's why that language is there.
Okay. Baal worship, sex with the sacred prostitutes in the field was part of the ritual. It's supposed to guarantee fertility in the field. So at planting time,
that's exactly that's what I'm referring to in Lawrence. That's what he writes about. Yeah.
It's very consistent in the world because the fall, ancient world, and the fertility right made sexual the sexual act a sacred act.
Mm-hmm.
And only later on it was transferred from the public into the privacy of the male man and woman as the God and the Shekhinah.
That's a good point. And even in the language, if you take Kadesh and Kadeshan, you're turning them into Kiddushin, it's the same sort of progress here. You're taking pagan structures which do have a sacral element to them. I mean, pagan religion is filled with the sacred. One, we should not think that they were not believers. They were believers, not in one God, but in lots. And lots of gods were very, very deep, very powerful. You can see that in India today. See it in other places, in the Far East, in Thailand, you can see that. Very deep religion. So you move from there to a totally different structure where it's privatized, in fact. Where instead of it being part of the cosmos and the sympathetic participation in the fertility of the world, the cosmos, the land, and so on, where suddenly it is turned into the family. And that then is Kiddushin. Right? That's the realm of the sacred. The realm of the sacred is in that limited area.
It is still an act of connecting with the divine.
No doubt about it. Okay. But the extent to which it is a connection with the divine is an interesting subject. There is a book which was attributed to the Ramban called Igeret HaKodesh. It's late 12th, early 13th century. I don't believe it was written by the Ramban. I think it was written that was middle, it's the end of the, and about the middle of the 13th century. It was written by Yosef ibn Gikatilia. And he wrote a famous book called Sharei Orah, one of the classic books of the Kabbalah. He wrote a book where he writes about the sexual experience itself as being one where one participates in the divine. So it's until the Kabbalah, until the 13th century, which are that kind of writing. You really don't find that in the Gemara. Okay? Very good. Now, 5A3 is where we're at. Here we come to the point of view of Rav Huna. And Rav Huna introduces another piece of the ceremony, but introduces it not as another piece. Anyway, Amar Rav Huna, 5A3 on the right side on the bottom, just before the line. Amar Rav Huna, Chupa Tona Mikal V'Chomer. Chupa is a form of acquisition, and we can learn this from a Kal V'Chomer argument. Right? Just read that argument for a moment. Ma kesef she'eino machil bitruma. If when you give money, she'eino machil bitruma doesn't allow the woman to consume truma, kone, it does Kesef does, money has the effect of creating an acquisition of the woman as the wife. Chupa shema'achelet bitruma eino din shetikneh. Chupa, which has the power to enable a woman to eat truma, shouldn't it logically then have the power to do what kesef does, what money does? That's his logical reasoning. That's the reasoning of the Kal Vachomer. Let's take it apart for a moment and then reflect on it. The Kal Vachomer, talks about the eating of truma. Truma is a small amount of the produce of the land of Israel. During the time when the temple stood, the amount of truma is not specified in the Torah. The rabbis fix it at 2% of produce. And that produce is forbidden to be eaten by a non-Kohen. Okay? Now, in our day, just a minimal amount is taken out as symbolic truma. The vegetable store that I go to near my house in the old city has a big sign that truma from Mazdot were taken out today. Everything is taken out. So a small amount, what would have been 2%, but would have even less today, is taken out. Now, today they're destroyed. And so it's only a small amount, a symbolic amount. During the time of the temple still stood, 2% was taken out, and it could only be eaten by Kohanim. And the Kohanim were functioning, they were doing the jobs of Kohanim, namely to serve in the temple, and they would eat the truma. The question now is, what if a Kohen marries an Israelite? Is that permissible? It is. There's no law that says a Kohen has to marry a Kohen. Kohen can marry any Jewish woman. Okay? So he marries an Israelite woman.
She's not a Kohen.
That's correct. A Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorcee. That's correct. A Kohen Gadol has further restrictions. Okay, he can't marry a widow, but the Kohen can't marry a divorcee. But let's say he marries someone who is permissible to him. Either she's not been married, well, she hasn't been married before. The truth is, even if she married a divorcee, it would still be the same issue. Because if a Kohen married a divorcee, she's still his wife. You're not allowed to do it, but if you've done it, it's not. Okay, that's the way the law works. So the question is, can she eat truma? And he basically is paid wages. He's paid by the coffers of the community. Coffers of the community are called truma, in effect, because that food is coming into the Kohanim, and that's what he and, by extension, his family will consume. So the truth is, yes, she can. She can, as long as she is his wife, she is permitted to eat truma. That implies as well that if she's not his wife, you know, if she were to get divorced, she can no longer eat truma. Right? It's not the kind of thing that once you've got it forever. You've got it until you don't have it. And then you don't have it. Okay, so she's got to be married to him. There is an exception, and that is if he dies and she is being supported by the children. Because the sons now are also Kohanim. And they have the obligation to support her. Well, where are they getting their support from? From Truma. Right? So in fact, even after he dies, as long as she is getting her support from them, she's in that position, she can eat truma. If for whatever reason she's not, she moves elsewhere, she decides she doesn't want their support, she's got enough money to live on her own, she doesn't care for that, at that point she can no longer eat truma. Okay? But the complicated thing is here, what do we mean when we say that she's married? at what point is she married enough so that she can eat truma? Okay? Because remember, there are two steps in marriage. One step in marriage is called kiddushin. The other step in marriage is called nisuin. So here, this argument of Rav Huna is, Ma kesef she'ein ol ma'achil bitruma, money. Namely, when you first get married, when you have the kinyan of kesef, well, you're sort of married at that point. We've just seen that you're sort of married, okay? Can't have relations with anybody else at that point. If you're going to dissolve it, you have to have a get, so they're sort of married. However, she can't eat truma yet. She can only eat truma after the nisuin, after the chuppah. Okay? So that's, the knowledge of that is what enables Rav Huna to build his kal vachomer. He's in the one situation, kesef, has the ability to create kiddushin, but it doesn't have the ability to create the situation where the woman could eat truma. Chuppah, on the other hand, has so much inherent power in creating that relationship between the man and the woman that it enables her to even go further and to eat truma. How much more so, he reasons, should it be possible to use chuppah to create the kiddushin? Okay?
The truma can be used by the Kohen as the down payment, so-called, for the kesef to buy the wine.
Oh, that's an interesting subject.
Yes, the other money.
Correct. If he were to, truma could be used.
Yeah.
Because it's kesef or shavekes.
So he can buy as many women as he wants, because it's a public money.
He can't just take whatever he wants. He gets a certain amount. He gets a certain amount, and it's, if you pay by the public coffer, it becomes yours. So it's true, but that's the way it works, and that's true for all public servants. Okay? Now, comment on chuppah. My experience of last evening. One of the interesting things that I had never seen, I suppose I had seen, I probably saw it once before, but it didn't register with me, is that the procedure, the two parts of the ceremony are different in Israel, and in Jerusalem in particular, from the way they are here. And I'll tell you how they're different. First of all, when do you break the glass at a wedding? Okay? At the end. You break it after the chuppah, after the nisui. In Yerushalayim, you break it after the kiddushin. I was absolutely amazed. I've not seen that before. They do the kiddushin. Mikodeshet. After that, they then say, Imeshkechech Yerushalayim Tishtach Yemini. If I forget the old Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its cunning, they break the glass. Psychology is fascinating, because the psychology that we're used to, and I believe it's the custom outside of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem custom per se, the psychology that we're used to is that when you break the glass, everybody says mazel tov, and it's sort of a cathartic moment in this ritual experience. Okay? There's a very, it's a lot of sense what they do. Because in Eshkechech Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini, you're remembering the destruction of the temple, and where I was looking at it. It's right there. And it's a sad thing. And the sense of the sadness is palpable. You're right in the spot. And you're thinking about these things. So the idea is that you shouldn't finish the wedding that way. You shouldn't finish the wedding with sadness. Instead, you put that as one of the things that now separates between the kiddushin and the nisuin. So all of that now comes in the middle. In addition to that, What they do is that they sign the ketubah underneath the chuppah. We sign the ketubah before you even go out. You sign the ketubah in a private space, and then you begin the wedding ceremony. So that's the way we do it in America. There, what they do is that after they've said Imeshkachech Yerushalayim, they do that. The next thing that they do is that they sign the ketubah. The ketubah has already been drawn up before, but the Eidim then come up, the witnesses come up, and they sign the ketubah underneath the chuppah. Underneath the chuppah, that's where it's done. And that also makes a lot of sense, because in fact the ketubah and its stipulations don't come into effect until Nisui, so the second part of the ceremony, right? So they do it in fact just as it falls into legal force. And that's the way it's done. That's the way it's done. So I was really very impressed by those two things, which are different from the way we conduct our wedding ceremonies here in the States. I don't know how it's done elsewhere, but I assume that everywhere else it's done the way we do it. And it's, what we saw was something that was peculiar, especially to Jerusalem. I just don't know. I don't think, as I've been saying, my daughter's wedding was outside of Jerusalem. But I don't remember anything from that wedding. I remember her. She was beautiful. Her husband was good, but I don't remember the procedure.
The ketubah was signed in private. We just went to a wedding recently and was signed during the middle of the ceremony.
Is that right? So then that must
so
be
it may be just...
Oh, I thought that was conservative or reform.
It's conservative.
Very interesting. With a lot of these things, I actually went to a reform ceremony once where we did it in the middle of the ceremony. I always suspect that what we're seeing now is that Israeli customs are coming to America. Mm-hmm. And we're beginning to see more and more of that. So conceivably, that could be a rabbi was from Israel, some of these things going on. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Now, even the word chuppah, though, we understand what the chuppah is. The chuppah is, for us, a canopy. And we know what we're talking about when we see the chuppah. And we assume, therefore, that what Rav Huna is speaking about is our chuppah. Well, I wanted to read to you the Shulchan Aruch. This is Rav Yosef Karo. 1570, roughly. In Evin HaEzer, the laws of marriage, in that section of the Shulchan Aruch called Evin HaEzer, Siman Nun He Seif Aleph, the major section 55, paragraph number 1. And here he reviews some of the things I believe that we read at the Rambam, but you'll see why I want to go on with this. Ha'arusa. A woman who is arusa in modern Hebrew is engaged, but in the Talmud it doesn't mean that, and he doesn't mean that either. It means the woman who has completed the first part of the ceremony, has been through the kiddushin. Asura leva'ala midivrei sofrim, is prohibited to her husbands by virtue of the law of the rabbis. Right? The rabbis have prohibited that. Kol zman shehi bevet aviha, all of the time that she is in her father's house. The haba ala rusato bevet chamiv, and the man who has relations with his arusa while she is still in her father's house, makina to makat mardut, he has transgressed the law of the rabbis, and therefore the punishment of that is lashes. So that's the punishment. The afilu biyikud asurim. Here, this is Rabbi Moshe Isselis, adds they're not even supposed to be together in private during that time. So, lachen arus shuhu im arusato bevayat achat. He says, lachen an arus, namely the male who has been through this, who is together with the female who passed the kiddushin, and they're in one house. They're living together. Okay? Mivarchin Sheva Brachot Pen Yit Yachadu. I don't know that it's talking about living together. They're in one house. You immediately say the Sheva Brachot, lest they be together. So in other words, you want to hurry it up because you don't want them to transgress the law of the rabbis. So 1, 2, 3, we finish it. We're not going to wait all the time that we'd have to wait. And we do the Nisui. There are those who say that they are not allowed to dwell in the same place. It doesn't mean live together, ladur b'yachat. It means to dwell in the same place. When we say live together, it has a sexual connotation to it. That doesn't have here. Shema yakutsu zebazeh, lest they'll get, lest they'll catch each other, as it were.
Yeah,
I guess so. Yakutsu, that's right. They'll get, that's a good choice. That translation will accept. The afilu, b'shiduchin b'lo arisin yesh lachush. Even if it's shiduchin, where people are close to each other without arisin, we're worried. Here I'm looking to where we are. Filu in kidsha b'di'a. Even if he makes the kiddushin, the sexual relations, asur lo lavoa leha bi'ashniya. He cannot have a second sexual relation with her. The Beit Avia, in her father's house, because that's where she goes now. Ad she'avia ota letoch peito. Until the time comes when he brings her into his house, v'yityached ima, and he will be alone with her, v'yafrishena lo, and he will separate her to him, the yichud zehu nikra knisa lachupa. That's the interesting thing. This yichud, this being alone with the bride, is called knisa lachupa. It is called entry into the chupa. So it's not at all clear here whether this is at all what we call chupa, or whether that's a term for saying she goes into his home. Okay? So there are among the commentators who understand it in both ways. That here in the Shulchan Aruch, he's reflecting the possibility of the, he's reflecting that one understanding that it means coming into the home and being alone with him in his home. And that's called Knisa Lachupa. Entering the chuppah. The hu hanikra nisuin b'chol makom. And universally in the Jewish world, that is called nisuin, the second piece of the ceremony. V'haba al arusatel l'shem nisuin, and the person who has sexual relations with this woman that he is already mekudash to. Okay, mekudash. She says, Mikodesha, Lishem Nisuim. He says, come on, we're going to go all the way, as it were. Now we're going to have sex to be married as Nisuim. Achar Shakidsha, after he's been through the Kiddushin, it's a Kiddushin with Kesef. Right? A Kiddushin with Kesef. They're not supposed to have sex. They have sex. Okay? And they want to do it in order to complete the whole picture here. Mishiyareba, that's a technical term in the Talmud, when he enters her, that means when they have the sex, kena'a, in fact, she has become acquired, v'na'aset nisu'a, and she becomes a nisu'a, harei hi ki'ishto l'chol davar, and she is his wife in every way. So, in other words, even though the formal way we have a certain ceremony of chuppah. In a primitive way, either you bring her into the house and that's called knisa lachuppah, or if they were to have sex with the intent then of that being the completion, and they're going to live together at that point. In fact, it is accepted as chuppah. Accepted as chuppah. In our Sefer Nesuah, Rei Hiki Ishto L'chol Davar, it tzarich levarech berchat hatanim bevet hachatam kodem ha-nesu'in. One should make the blessing of berchat hatanim, of the blessing of hatanim, in the house of the hatan before the nesu'in. That's the Sheva Brachot. Right? The Sheva Brachot that we recite, the seven blessings, they are the key activity of the nisu'in of the chuppah. So the second ceremony, the year later ceremony, in effect is the recitation of the Sheva Brachot. And it appears that it was done in his house, if the meaning of chuppah was to go into his house. So in some way what they did was that they went into the house and recited the Sheva Brachot, and that was the completion of the ceremony. Okay? And now, this is the comment of Rabbi Moshe Isserles. The Yeshomim, there are those who say, the Chuppah ena Yichud. The meaning of Chuppah is not that they are alone together in one place. Ela kol shehidiyah hechatan leveito l'shem nisu'im. One possibility is any groom who brings a wife into his house for the sake of nisuin. Well, that in effect is yichud. That's a form of yichud there, but yichud in the house, as opposed to the possibility, for example, we have in our weddings today, after the completion of the ceremony, the bride and the groom go into yichud, which is where they are together with each other. Okay? Yesh omrim shehachuppah hi sheporsin sudar al rosham. There are those who say that the meaning of chuppah is that they stretch a cloth over their heads, bishat abracha, when the blessings are said. That is in fact what we do. So you see that finally what we do, we've finally gotten to what we do. We're second Yesh omrim. Second Yesh Omrim here. Okay? The Yesh Omrim the Chuppat Bitula Nishiyatza Behinuma. And there are those who say that the Chuppah of a Bitula, of a virgin woman, is when she goes out with a veil over her face. And that's the meaning of Chuppah. Right? A woman in a first marriage traditionally will always wear a veil over the face. Okay? Second marriages, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Usually no, sometimes yes, no. But here he says that that is one of the meanings of chuppah. The chuppah is covering, it's covering her face. That's the meaning of chuppah. The almana mishenit yachadu. Since a betula in the first marriage, she wears a veil, the second marriage then, for an almana, for a widow, would be when they have yichud together. Okay, that would be the meaning then of chuppah. Then he goes on. The haminhag pashut achshav. The custom is widespread now. Likrot chuppah ma, to call chuppah, makom shemachnisim sham yiriah trusa agabe klunzot. We call the chuppah a place where people go under a cloth that is stretched over poles. Umachnisim tachteha hechatan v'hakala b'rabim. And we bring underneath it the chatan and the kala in public. Umikadshasham, the kiddushin takes place sham. Umivarchin sham birchat erusin v'nisu'in. And the blessings of the erusin, namely the first cup of wine, those two blessings that are said over there, and the blessings of the nisuin, which is the Sheva Brachot, are said under that. The achar kach molichin otam levayet, the ochlin biyachet b'makom tzanua. Afterwards, they are taken to a house, and they eat there together, b'makom tzanua, in a hidden place. Namely, other people are not there. They're there just together with each other. V'zehu ha-chupa ha-noheget achshav. And this is the chuppah that is customary now. He's writing in the 16th century. But we do exactly the same thing today. We have exactly that procedure. But it's interesting that that procedure was not always clear. That in fact it was seen as something of... It was a yesh omrim, but it became the widespread procedure. So chuppah can mean, and we don't really know now what the Gemara is referring to as chuppah. It wasn't until the 16th century that our notion of chuppah becomes the clear dominant notion of chuppah. It's not at all clear what the Gemara means when it means chuppah. Okay, because it could mean any of the above.
Rashi or Rambam don't.
Rambam does. Rashi does not. Rashi does not describe what the chuppah is. Rambam does comment. Rambam says the chuppah is yichud. Okay? The chuppah is yichud. So he does not have the notion of the chuppah. Exactly, yes. Both of them are significant coverings. The first one would be the symbolic covering of the bride. Now, if the bride appears in a bridal gown, then it has its own symbolism. Okay, so that would be the symbolism there. The more common one, the one that we're familiar with, which is the covering over the top, what that is a roof. And what happens then is that, in fact, he brings her under his roof, which is symbolized by the roof over their heads, namely the chuppah. Okay? So it's a symbolic roof.
From what you read earlier, it sounded like interchangeable. You
know,
either the cover,
it could be a cigar or... No, it's either this custom or that. It's not necessarily interchangeable. There was this custom, and there was that custom, and there was another custom, okay? Those are different customs for what chuppah means. But I don't think they're interchangeable. Okay? They're just different.
So the bride and groom eat privately, and we went to a Hasidic wedding where I believe they ate and then joined all these hundreds of other people, but they really had their meal, everyone else was eating, but they knew it was
so last night, what happens is that when you leave the chuppah, the friends of the bride and the groom dance the bride and the groom to Yichud. They went to Yehud, and that was a very exciting, you know, everybody, two of them went wherever Yehud was, they went to Yehud. Then I had to go to the airport. So I said to Ezra, I said to my son, I said, how long are they going to be in Yehud? So he says, well, you never know. he said, so what custom are these are his friends, and he knows what the local customs are, I don't. So he says, well, sometimes half an hour and a half. and then he reminds me, he says, or maybe like Hanalia, where you wondered whether they were ever coming to the wedding. any of you are at Hanalia's wedding?
Myself.
We're sitting at Hanalia's, my daughter's wedding, they're sitting there. They never show up. So, she's wondering. The father is wondering. Nothing happened. So eventually they showed up. But not till a lot of people were ready to go home. So there are all kinds of... in an American wedding, you usually don't do that. The Israelis take this much more seriously.
I think it's a little observed.
But so today I talked to Ezra. I said, "What happened?" So he said, "Well, what happened was they came back, after a certain amount of time, I didn't turn out exactly how much time, and they spent the rest of the night, which was a long evening. He said it was a long wedding, with everybody, with dancing, and that's what usually happens. So I think that's along the lines of what you're describing.
There seems to be illogic here. If you need Tudishin to get to the point where you can do chuppah, how can he be talking about chuppah before?
Well, that's what the Gemara is going to say in the next stage. You're exactly right. The Gemara is going to raise exactly that problem with this so-called logic of Rav Huna. Rav Huna brings it as logical, and the Gemara will raise several logical problems, one exactly what you just said.
I went to
Yahoo. Into the room? They were sick?
I fainted at under the chuppah, and I could see her.
The bride fainted?
Well, just only because I got there just in time.
Good for you.
And then the whole question, what to do? So they brought a chair, and I wanted her flat, for her brain. But this was the worst of all of the fainting episodes I've been called on. But I was really concerned about it, so immediately
So you went to the Yichud?
I was there.
Good for you. Did they have good food?
A whole room full of people. You worried about her, but she's embarrassed to go on with the ceremony. That guy is just of all of the ones. And I'm sitting there, I'm making the decision between this room full of people and the one sick young woman.
She came back to life.
Oh, yeah.
She had a good doctor. See, the only experience I never had a bride pass out. I had grooms. I always assume the brides don't pass out. And men, very easy. Several times I've seen the men are falling over. Men are really in very difficult. I never had an experience.
They didn't want to go. The bride's father kept pushing
her into charity. Yeah, I understand, sure.
At my wedding, the demographics came quite a bit later after the
Yichud. After the Yichud?
Yeah. I think they used to.
Maybe that's what you think. After the meal in the Katamazon, in a wedding meal, as during the Sheva Brachot, you have Sheva Brachot during the entire week of a marriage. And there you say Sheva Brachot.
But it also took place during the
Yichud. It's also under the chuppah. You are one of those grooms I'm talking about.
I'm focused.
Unfocused, a nice way to say it.
Is the Rambam's idea of Yichud the meal or a sexual moment?
I don't think it's necessarily sexual. He doesn't say it's sexual. Let me see if I can read it to you. I think it's... Maybe there's a reference here. Wait a second. Okay, just 10 minutes.
I think it makes sense given the way you began today. The chuppah, our sense of the chuppah is in a sense symbolic and euphemism. Even in the commentary, it comes out that way. And that really, chuppah is. Why do you bring a person into your home? It's to have permanent sexual relations.
Correct.
So that's, in a way, that should be the whole point of chuppah. The word or the concept is just a roundabout way of describing the permissible sex between a man and a woman.
Correct.
So so I'm just interested.
I read to your dramas in a sec. What I read to you from the Shulchan Aruch is obviously quoted from the Rambam. Harusa asura levala midivrei sofrim. The woman who is, quote, engaged, but who has been through kiddushin, is forbidden to her husband by a rabbinic edict, called manjehi bezeit avia, during the entire time that she is in her father's house. V'haba al arusato bezeit chamiv, man who has sexual relations with his arusa in his father-in-law's house, makinato makat mardu. He receives lashes for having transgressed the law of the rabbis. The afilu im kibsha b'di'a, even if he made the kiddushin with sexual relations, asur lo lavo alea b'yashni'a, he cannot have a second relation with her, b'beit avia, in her father's house, ad shi avia otam letoch beito, until he brings her into his house, v'yishyachet ima, and will be alone with her, v'yafrishena lo, and will separate her for himself. The yichud zehu hanikra knisa lachupa. This yichud is what is called entering the chuppah. Zehu hanikra nisu in b'chol makom. And this is what is referred to people, to universally, as nisuin. Okay?
If they didn't use the cloth, then what did he mean by chuppah?
The chuppah, lechapot is to cover, right? So it is the covering of his roof. It's the real thing. It's not a symbolic thing, as Dan was saying. It's the real thing, the permanence of the relationship that's established in that real thing, which is the real house, into his house.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a little confused.
Okay.
Is it sex? Is sex holy because there's marriage? Or is marriage holy because there's sex?
First of all, sex is holy because there's marriage. And following that, marriage is holy because there's sex.
So
I can't. I just put it in a certain order.
You switch it around.
I just put it in a certain order. The order is important. But I'm now reflecting on what I said to you before, this writing of Jekatilia in his book, and this is picked up by later writers, sex brings holiness to the marriage, but first marriage brings holiness to the sex, because you saw as the Rambam said, you can have sex without marriage. It's not called holy.
And is this why a premarital sex is frowned upon in certain circles?
Is this what, well, premarital sex is forbidden, what I'm frowned upon. It's a deep frown. It's forbidden according to the law of the rabbis.
That's not for the harlot.
What?
That's not for the harlot.
Well, you're not allowed. You're going to get back to what he said. You're not allowed to have relations with a Jewish harlot. And you're not supposed to be a Jewish man. All of that is true. Okay? Yes.
We are talking all the time that he needs to bring her to his home. What happens if the young couple decided to live in her father's house?
Oh, that's a good question, because that was common. That was common. Correct. It's still common. It's happening more and more these days. It happened to some of you. Because as long as that is established as the groom's house, as long as it is established also as the groom's house, or the groom's house can be the room where they are going to reside, then that's his house. It's the groom's house.
So it's a dedicated place that will be there. So it's a change in his status.
Because,
well, otherwise he'd be a future son-in-law having sex in the father-in-law's
house. Oh, correct. Correct. Yeah, you're right. And how would you symbolize that? You would have to say the Sheva Brachot. The Sheva Brachot is what would symbolize the fact that this was now different than it was before. Okay?
So we need to finish the ceremony.
To have to legitimize it, you need the ceremony. That's absolutely correct.
This whole idea of building the home, the chuppah, symbolizing the home, because you also, when they talked about the harlot and the arrangement, the wage, it was by the rope. It was not
correct.
The home.
The transitory nature of it.
Right. It was transitory without the concept of making the home, providing for the future, and that big super commitment.
Right. You got it. You got it. That's exactly right.
When did the seven circles,
the
circle and seven
sun,
when did that appear?
Not in these books. These are traditional.
So it's somewhat later.
Correct. I don't know the origin of it. I don't know when it became a basic part of our ceremony.
Or might it have been from then that period, but just it was just a customary.
All of that is possible, but I would doubt it, to tell you the truth, because usually, if it is, you'll see it.
Oh.
Usually, if it is, but I can't say for sure. I really don't know.
Okay. What's the name of the book?
Igeret HaKodesh. Igeret HaKodesh is available. Hard to find. You can find it in Hebrew.
You said
when you're
saying
Kedat Moshe of Israel,
the
Chupa is mentioned
in the Torah?
No, the
Chupa
is not mentioned.
So why
then? Listeners, we'll conclude with this. It's another good question. The assumption you would have is that the Chupa is mentioned in the Torah. Right? Of course, the Chupa is not mentioned in the Torah. That's one of the issues now behind the argument here in the Gemara that we will continue with next week. Because Rav Huna introduces this with a logical argument as opposed to introducing it because he says it's said in the Torah. All on the surface, we saw that the Rambam didn't agree with this, but on the surface, all the other three methods we've seen biblical proofs that they came from the Torah. Here he introduces this based on logic, and solely on logic. Okay? So, at least from what we know so far, and I can give you a preview, we're going to come to the same conclusion, not in the Torah. It's just not there.
But we can use it so much more than we can.
Well, we can see. No, first of all, you don't say that. But you say unanimous. You say Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, not for the chuppah, for the kiddushin. When you give the ring, Harei at mekudeshet li b'tabat zo Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. Okay, the only thing you say in the ceremony Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, which is verbally said, is the ring, which is keset for the kiddushin. Okay. In fact, it also says Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael in the ketubah, but that's because the ketubah is also from the Torah. Okay, but well, not the star. Ketubah is different from the star, because the star is a star that says, with this document I thee wed according to the law of Moses in Israel. Ketubah doesn't say that. The ketubah is a financial arrangement.
But the ketubah is achrazat nisuin.
It says what?
Achrazat nisuin.
Not in our ketubah, we don't say that. Not there.
It specifies the obligation, it specifies the day, it specifies the party, it specifies the windows, and it specifies the event. This is achrazat nisuin.
Hachrazat, you say. Hachrazat, proclamation of the
announcement.
But it doesn't make the marriage. It does not make the marriage.
It's one part
of the marriage.
No,
not only is it a sin of marriage, it's not a part of the kiddushin, it's a part of the erus, and a part of the erusin, it's a part of the nisuin. But technically speaking, many people will think that it's part of the Kiddushin, because it's a written document. Now, that was, it is a written document. But technically speaking, what they are referring to here is making the Kiddushin by a written document is very specific. The Ketubah is really different. The Ketubah is an arrangement of responsibility, a statement of the responsibilities of the groom to the bride in the marriage. Okay? So be
continued. Thank you very much.
You thought the key was to the